Remember, last week we started looking at the sixth trumpet judgment, and my intention was to go a little further than we will go today. I think partly that's because there's a lot of details as we move forward through the trumpet judgments that, especially when it comes to the sixth trumpet judgment, that are really a little bit more hard for us to grasp and understand. And so I think that, you know, looking at some of the wording that's used and even how it's referenced in other places in Scripture will help us to understand even perhaps the most difficult one to understand as we look at these trumpet judgments. So this is the sixth one out of the seven that we find that are going on in Revelation. And of course, already we've noticed from the first through the sixth that things are going from bad to worse for those who do not believe in the Lord and do not belong to the Lord during this time period that we would describe from chapter 7 as the Great Tribulation. But this is just a real quick review of where we started, and we'll read our way through it as well. But last week we looked at the components of the judgment. If you remember from verses 13 and 14, there are three main components that deal with the sixth trumpet judgment. The first component is the call from the angel, which is very similar to the call of the angels that we've already looked at there in verse 13. The sixth angel sounded. The sixth angel trumpeted his trumpet. That's the first component. The second component is the voice from the altar, where you continue on there in verse 13, where John then heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. It's a golden altar that we've already seen before in chapter 8. It's also something that is likely something we've seen in chapter 6. But that's the second component, and that leads to the third component, which is a command to the angel, to the sixth angel that trumpeted his trumpet there in verse 14, where a heavenly voice, you know, some believe it is an angel. I believe it's an angel, perhaps the angel that we met there in chapter 8. Others believe it's the voice of God himself, maybe even the combined voice of the martyrs still that are under that altar. But either way, it's a heavenly voice commanding this angel, verse 14, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And so those are the three components of the judgment. And the angel that initiates this judgment by blowing his trumpet is actually now actively involved in this judgment when he does what he's told. And that is a unique feature from all of these different trumpet judgments, is it's the only one who, after he initiates it by blowing the trumpet, is now actively involved in it. And so that leads us to the consequences, and this is pretty much the rest of what we find in the sixth trumpet judgment. The consequences of the judgment there in verse 15, what happens when this angel heeds his command? The four angels are loosed. So he's commanded, loose them, release them, let them free, and he does. He looses them, he releases them, he lets them free. The four angels are loosed, verse 15, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men. Now, from this verse, we learned about the plan of the release of these four angels. They were prepared for this by God. We saw the period, not necessarily referencing an entire period, but rather the point when it would start. And then also the very purpose is to slay the third part of men. And that third part is something that we've seen also already in these trumpet judgments. But what we learn from all of these things about the consequences of the judgment is that they're all according to and under the sovereign hand of God. God is in complete control of everything that's going on, and no matter what happens, believers during this time can rest assured that God is in complete control. And if God is going to be in complete control when these four angels are released, imagine how much control God has over the affairs of our world even today. And that is why we can rest in him. We are assured of that. Well, in the next section that we come to, this is all part of the consequences. So we're kind of picking up where we left off. We saw the plan, the period, the purpose. Now in verses 16 through 19, we can call this the power of these four angels that are released, their power. This refers to what happens when they're finally loosed, released from their watery prison. And if you remember, the idea is they are either in the great river Euphrates or even just on it. So the banks of the river could be the very bars of their prison, because the Greek word is a p, it's on, they're on that. But what happens? Well, we're going to read verses 16 through 19 and then just actually only cover about a verse and a half, but hopefully you'll understand why as we move forward. Picking up there in verse 16, this is the power of these four angels that are released. and the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000. And I heard the number of them, John says. And thus I saw the horses. So he hears about them, and then again he sees them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and of brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails. For their tails were like unto serpents and had heads, and with them they do hurt. Obviously, this seems a lot more descriptive and perhaps even more difficult than a lot of the other ones that we've looked at. Clearly, some of the things that we learned about the locusts were symbolic. Also, some of the things that we'll learn about this cavalry is also going to be symbolic. But this verse and these verses really describe the power of the four angels and how they will be able to fulfill their purpose. And again, that purpose is, verse 15, to slay the third part of men in this world. And so that's really what we're going to focus on, is the beginning part of this power. And so the very first thing that John describes for us is the powerful agents that the four angels will use to accomplish their deadly mission. And those agents are referred to there in verse 16. The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them. Now, one of the strange things about the trumpet, this particular trumpet judgment, is that the transition between the four angels in verse 15 and the army that is referred to here in verse 16 is rather abrupt. We're not even told like where they came from, how they got there, you know, what was the process by which they came. We're not really told. So the connection between the four angels in verse 15 and the army there in verse 16, even though it's not entirely clear, we know that they're related. We know that they're connected because verse 16 actually begins with the word and. The Greek word is kai. It's a very familiar word that is a coordinating conjunction that really joins these two verses together. So there's some clear relationship, and yet how they're connected is not entirely clear. And then once we get into verse 16, there's no further mention of these four angels, but rather these horses and the horsemen that are referred to. So even though we don't know where this army in verse 16 comes from, they do seem to become the very weapon that the four angels will use to kill so many people. And that seems to be the connection point between verses 15 and 16. The four angels, they are using this army for their own very weapon. It may even be intended for us to see that, as one writer puts it, the angels are then identified with the host which they marshal. And so even though we have four angels in verse 15, this massive host of horsemen and horses are actually going to be the very tool by which these four angels kill a third part of the earth. But as we'll see as we move forward, this host will, just like the locusts under the fifth trumpet judgment, be made up of spiritual and demonic beings. And we'll see that as we go forward. They may even be the very demons that possess the locusts. Again, we don't have all the details. But if you remember, those demons in the locusts really only had sway over the world for 5 months, right? So what are they going to do after the 5 months? Are they going to go back into the bottomless pit? Well, we don't know. We're not told. Maybe they become part of the cavalry that we find here in verses 15 and 16. But instead of being limited in their mission, if you remember, the demonically inspired locusts could only torment men. They could not kill them. But they would torment them to the point where they wanted to die. But now we actually have this demonic army being able to kill. And so, you know, some might say that these are the demons, the very demons that came out of the pit of hell, and now they are different, given a different form. So, it might be those demons. It might be the demonic beings already on earth. Obviously, we know there are spiritual, demonic, fallen beings in this world today. We saw them even in the life of Jesus. That might be the case. So whereas there's a host of demonic beings in the world today, more will come yet to come there in the fifth trumpet judgment. Some believe that these demonic beings are also bound with the four angels in or on the Euphrates River. Again, we don't know for sure. They might even be more demonic beings that come out of the bottomless pit after the locusts. We really have no way of knowing, but our attention is now turned to this unique army. In the King James there in verse 16, it's described as the army of the horsemen. But the interesting thing is that in the Greek, army is actually plural, and horsemen, the word for horsemen, is actually singular. So if you just took those words, it would be the armies of the horseman, which doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Perhaps a better way to understand it is, as the Revised Standard Version puts it, the troops of the cavalry. So troops would be plural, dealing with armies, soldiers, and cavalry would be singular, kind of like the group of horses, the group of horsemen as well. Other translations put it as mounted troops. And so if you picture those grand old Canadian Mounties up north, right? That's kind of the idea here. But they're not running around individually. They're running around together as a mighty host. So perhaps a better way to put it is the troops of the cavalry. That reflects both the plural for army and the singular for horsemen. They are the mounted troops that are going to go throughout the world, being used by these four angels, ultimately to accomplish God's sovereign purpose to slay the third part of men. So however you put it, the skill of these troops is implied. They are a single band. So it is not cavalries, it's one cavalry. It's a single band. And they are unified in their comprehensive quest to follow their leaders all throughout the four corners of the world. And so, again, I think that might be one of the reasons why you have the four angels, to indicate that even though they come from one source, the great river Euphrates, their purpose is to spread out to the four corners of the earth, which may also be represented by the four corners, the four horns of the altar. And so really, these demonic beings, part of this mounted cavalry, are going to do what they are required to do. They're going to go out and fulfill the very mission of these four angels. Again, if you remember, in the first four trumpet judgments, the fraction of a third could have been satisfied by a single but sizable location. You know, in the first trumpet judgment, it's talking about how there's going to be a third part of the earth that's burned up. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be comprehensive over the globe. It could be associated with a very sizable location, single location, to make up a third of the globe to burn up, or a third of the seas is going to be turned to blood, and all of these things. A single area, vast in its scope, could be indicated, but here, it's no single place. It's anywhere and everywhere that man is, because a third of them will be killed. They're spreading out. That's the idea here. It's comprehensive. They have a comprehensive mission throughout the world. They will wage their war throughout the entire world. And really, it's a lot like those four horsemen and their colored horses that we learned about in chapter 6. If you remember, we had the seals being broken, right? And you've got the white horse, the red horse, the pale horse, and all of those things, the black horse. And their intention was to go throughout the globe, to go throughout the world, to wage their war as well. It points back to the book of Zechariah, where these horses were sent out to run to and fro throughout the world. And I think that's the idea here, is that even though they have a unified purpose, and even though they have a comprehensive purpose, yet they will truly cover the entire globe to accomplish their purpose. Their deadly skill is clearly implied. But even though that will also be described later on in these verses that we read, it's really the scale of these troops that to John is most significant, the scale, even the size of these troops. Because he focuses now on the number. He focuses on the number. And in the King James, it's put as 200,000 troops. The underlying Greek word for the number 10,000, it's there on your lesson guide, is murios. You have the transliteration as well as the Greek word. So a direct translation or even transliteration would be two myriads of myriads. And the impression is, with myriads of myriads being a lot, you have that doubled, two myriads of myriads, you're talking about a huge, sizable scale of troops. And if we were just to multiply it out in our common arithmetic, it would be 200 million. 200 million. 200,000 is 200 million. Now, this is significant because of something that we've already seen in Revelation. In fact, if you go back to chapter 5, verse 11, excuse me. Now, Obviously, we're not on the earth anymore. We're back in the throne room of heaven in chapter 5. But there in the heavenly throne room, if you look at verse 11, John says that I beheld, excuse me, I beheld and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne and the beast and the elders. Now, these are good angels, all right? These are angels in heaven. These are angels that have not fallen. But look at what he described them as. The number of them is significant. The number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, and then he adds, and thousands more, if you will. So here we have myriads of myriads of good angels in heaven. And they're used to describe these holy angels, and then it's added thousands of thousands. So the impression here is that they are innumerable, all right? It's not 100 million, so myriads of myriads would be 100 million, but he's not focused on the 100 million. He's talking about an innumerable host. It's 100 million plus thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of more. So keep that in mind. So the point is, in chapter 5, that the number of good holy angels in heaven was innumerable. Now, chapter 5, verse 11 points back to something that we find in the book of Daniel. You don't have to turn there, because what we find in chapter 5, verse 11 is very similar to what we find in Daniel 7:10, where in Daniel it has the Hebrew equivalent of what we find here in chapter 5, verse 11. Look at that verse while I read Daniel 7:10. It says, as Daniel witnesses this scene in heaven, there is a fiery stream that issued and came forth from before him, before God. Thousands ministered unto him. So that's where we get the thousands and thousands from chapter 5, verse 11. And 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And then the judgment was set and the books were opened. Now, obviously, this is talking about something that is even future from what we find in this part of Revelation, where the books of judgment will be opened. But the idea is the same. We have 100 million good angels, holy angels, heavenly angels, and then added to that are thousands upon thousands upon thousands. And so, heavenly angels, there's a bunch. But now we come back to chapter 9, verse 16. And now he hears a number that is twice the size of the 100 million that he saw and heard about in chapter 5. So the scale of this force, this evil demonic force, is massive. And we would say demonic because of the association of verse 16 with what we found back in chapter 5, verse 11, with what we find back in Daniel chapter 7 as well. This seems to describe a spiritual host, but not of good angels, but of demons, of demonic angels. This is so massive that there was no way for John to have been able to count them. And that's why at the end of verse 16 he says, I heard the number of them. Someone had to tell him how many. It was so many. 200 million is not something that he could have just stood there and counted, you know. That'd take a lot of hands and a lot of feet to, you know, figure out how many there were. There's no way he could have counted them, and so he says, I heard them. Someone had to tell them. So the impression is very, very grave. This is a huge cavalry of spiritual beings that are ready to unleash death in this world on those who do not believe. But if you think about this, if you think about 200 million troops, 200 million horsemen, in addition to the troops, what are those troops sitting on? Horses, right? So if there's 200 million troops, how many horses would there be of this cavalry? Another 200 million. So if you add them up, if these horses are demonic beings themselves, and it could very well be because of the activity of the horses that we'll read about later on, it could be that there are demons in charge of other demons that are going to go throughout the world and kill a third of this world. It could very well be that we have 400 million evil angels in this verse alone. And he hears the number of them. Later on, he'll see and recognize what they consist of. But what is the significance of this great number? Not just the 100 million angels that are good in heaven, you know, plus thousands and thousands more. Here we have upwards of 400 million evil angels. It means that not only does this force seem innumerable, it also seems insurmountable. And I think that's the impression that John is trying to also give to the readers. God is trying to impress John with a number, and now John is trying to impress the number upon his readers and says, imagine an evil force of this magnitude waging its war all throughout the world to kill a third of the population of this world. Imagine how that would feel to a Christian in John's day, thinking in terms of the Roman army and the Roman cavalry and the Roman dominance even over Christians. Imagine what that must have felt like to them. 200 million, two myriads of myriads, is double a myriad or the myriads of myriads back in 511. And maybe that was to cause the readers to start to think, well, could it be that the powers of hell are greater than the powers of heaven? Myriads of myriads versus two myriads of myriads, or maybe even four myriads of myriads. But obviously, we remember, back in chapter 5, verse 11, the thousands and thousands more. So even though it might seem like it's insurmountable, even though it seems like it's innumerable, ultimately the fact is, God's people and God's power is greater than the power of the devil himself. And we really need to remember Martin Luther's hymn that you know we learned about a number of years ago. It says, and though this world with devils filled, I mean, that's a picture here, right? This world is full of devils. Though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, and there will be believers at this time, and they might experience the impression of just how dangerous and deadly this world is, Martin Luther reminds us, we will not fear, for God has willed his truth to triumph through us. Yes, two myriads of myriads is greater than one myriad of myriads. But the angels, or the thousands upon thousands, is far greater than the 400 possible million spiritual beings that are unleashed on this world. Because even though these agents of the devil will be very powerful, these agents of the four angels will be very powerful, they're limited. It's this many and no more. Whereas the heavenly angels, it's thousands and thousands. Here it's 200 million, no more. God limits who they are and what they can do. So, verse 16, I heard the number of them. But then in the next line, if you look at verse 17, he also says, and thus I saw the horses in the vision. So, this is another one of those cases where John both hears and sees something, all right? And a lot of times, when he sees and hears something, they're connected with each other. They might even seem a little disparate. They might seem a little different at first, but they're talking about the same thing. And this is one of the things that we saw back in chapter 5, again in the throne room vision, when John heard someone say, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, right? And then he turns and he's looking to see a lion, and what does he see instead? He hears about a lion, but he sees a lamb, the Lord Jesus Christ. Because lion and lamb both describe the Lord Jesus. So was he seeing and hearing two different things? No, he was seeing and hearing the same thing, just described in two different ways. I personally think this is what's going on in chapter 7 as well, when we're talking about the 144,000 and the great multitude. You know, it's describing the same group in different terms. I think this is what we're going on here, but in this case, it's practically the same thing. Okay, so what he sees and what he hears, there's no real main difference that we see going on. Because at this point, what John sees is comparable to what he hears. And so what does he see? He sees the powerful appearance of this deadly force. And so much of what we find in the sixth trumpet judgment deals with the powerful appearance of this deadly force. Now, we need to take a moment to look at the phrase that he uses at the beginning there of verse 17 when he says, and thus I saw the horses in the vision. Now, if you've been with us any length of time in the book of Revelation, we pretty much know that John is seeing this in a vision. I mean, after all, that's what the whole book of Revelation is. It's God revealing to John things that are happening, you know, at that time as well as into the future in a visionary way. In fact, in chapter 1, verse 10, he said that it all started when he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And so that's just a common way of putting that he was experiencing these things, not in body. It wasn't his physical eyes or his physical senses that were being engaged. It was his spiritual senses that were being engaged, his spiritual sight, his spiritual hearing, even his spiritual touch, even his spiritual activity. So it was a visionary thing. Then in chapter 4, verse 2, we're told again that he was caught up in the spirit to go into the third heaven. You know, there was a door open in heaven. I was caught in the spirit to go on up there and saw some of these amazing things. So again, in a visionary way, his body was on earth, but his spirit was in heaven in that way. So here there seems to be some significance to the use of this word in this place. Everything so far has been visionary. And so why is he saying now that I saw the horses in the vision? It could just be repetition, a reminder of his ecstatic state. Or it might even be to provide a contrast with what John saw in verse 1 of this same chapter. Because if you remember, that's actually how the first verse starts. I saw a star fall from heaven. Now we know that he saw that in a visionary way, all right? He saw this in the spirit. So God was showing him things that were going to happen in this way. But the very next time that he says, I saw, is here in verse 17. So I saw a star, and now I saw the horses in the vision. And I think the significance of this idea of seeing things in a vision shows us that what John saw in the first part of this chapter, in verses 1 through 12, could refer to a visible but spiritual army of locusts that will be possessed by demons and led by their king. And if you know, what we looked at, the name of that king is Abaddon or Apollyon, whether you look at it Hebrew or in Greek. And so could very well be these are literal locusts that God showed him. This is the way it's going to pan out. You know, it's going to be a certain kind of species of locust that the world has never seen before. And yet they will actually be demonically possessed and demonically controlled. But there might be a contrast here, and I think there is a contrast here when he says, now I see something in a visionary way. So he's about to see and describe for us not something visible in this world, but rather something that is invisible. So an invisible spiritual army of demons, bringing death upon the third of mankind in as many ways as possible. And we'll explore a little bit more of this as we move forward. But I think one of the reasons why we can see it this way is because invisible spiritual armies are nothing new in the Bible. It's something that if you've read your Bible and like the time, you've come across a couple of times. In fact, why don't we go to a couple of those places. Keep your finger here in Revelation 9. Go back with me to Psalm 68, first of all. Psalm 68. And in Psalm 68, verse 17. If someone could read that verse for us. Psalm 68, verse 17. Thank you. All right, so here we have not just a cavalry of angels, but even chariots of God, chariots of angels. Now, if a cavalry was something that was feared back in ancient days, chariots were feared even more. And what is this? What is this but a spiritual army of angels with their chariots? Now, that seems pretty clear on the face of it, but we have something even more clear when you go back to 2 Kings chapter 6. So keep that in mind. So we've got the chariots, which show that God's power is greater than any other power of men, any other army of men. But go now with me to 2 Kings chapter 6. We're not going to read through the entire passage, but starting in verse 8 through verse 23, we're told that the king of Syria was actually coming up to seize the prophet Elisha. And Elisha, he wasn't afraid, you know, though the world with devils fear filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God has willed. And Elisha was certainly a man who knew the power of God's word in these circumstances. He was not afraid, but Elisha's servant was. And so if you look at verses 16 and 17, you probably remember this. But if someone could read those two verses, listen to what Elisha tells his servant. Now, obviously, we're not told the number here, but this is a spiritual army, an invisible spiritual army that God actually then opens the eyes not only of Elisha to see, but even of Elisha's servant to see, to really quell any fear about the Syrian army that is going around them. So when you come back here to Revelation chapter 9, this seems to be what's happening to John in these verses. He says, I saw the horses in the vision. And so even though all of this is in a vision, He's wanting to stress that this is a true visionary experience to show us that this massive spiritual force that will bring much death to this world is actually invisible to the eyes of men, even as they were invisible to the eyes of Elisha's servant back in 2 Kings. So here he is given this vision of these horsemen and these horses so that he can describe them to us so that we can know about their true nature, and especially the believers that will be alive at this time will be able to understand their true nature and not fear. We will not fear, for God has willed his truth to triumph through us. And so then in verse 17, he describes the appearance, first of all, of the horses and the horsemen. And that's why he says, "And thus I saw the horses in the vision and them that sat on them." So obviously we have a focus on the horse, but not just the horses, but also the troops of the cavalry, the troops that are sitting on those horses. Now, already we see a transition, another transition taking place in this trumpet judgment. It's a transition of John's focus from the horsemen that we saw already in verse 16. Remember, his focus was on the troops or the army. Okay, so I was looking at the people, or the angelic beings, if you will, the demons, okay, who were on these horses. Now in verse 17, I see the horses and them that sat on them. So he's transitioning from the ones that are sitting on them to the horses and the ones that are sitting on them. And then, in the very next line, the focus will shift to the horses themselves, because they will actually be the main source of death and destruction in this judgment. And so that's kind of an interesting shift and transition within the sixth trumpet judgment. He says, I'm going to tell you about a whole bunch of troops, 200 million of them. And now I'm going to describe to you the troops and the horses. But then eventually he'll just get to the horses and ignore the troops. So obviously he brings out, God brings out to John, and John brings out to us what he wants us to know at that moment, at that time. But what about these troops and what about these horses? Well, both of them are probably in view when John says that they were having breastplates. It's kind of referenced in the accusative cases that we find going on in this particular verse. So it could refer to the horses and them that sat on them, all of them having breastplates. Now, we have heard about breastplates already in this chapter. All the way back in verse 9, we saw that the locusts had breastplates. And if you remember, they were made out of iron, right? They were very strong. They were powerful. The word for breastplate is thorax. It's something that we're familiar with our own bodies, with our own anatomy, with the anatomy of other insects. The thorax, the breastplate, was a piece of defensive armor. It was used to protect the chest, obviously, but especially the vital organs in the chest. You've got your stomach, you've got your lungs, but especially what do you have? You have your heart, okay? So keep that in mind, because these breastplates were not only to protect the heart, they were also to do something more. So the meaning that we find with the locusts, with their breastplates, is also true here. The breastplates mean that they are indestructible, okay? There's nothing that you can aim at these locusts or aim at this cavalry to defeat them, because they will do their mission according to what God has in store. But this demonic cavalry is mighty and strong as well, because both the horses and their riders are wearing these breastplates. Now, if you ever watched any movies that took place in, you know, the Middle Ages or medieval times, actually there's a dinner show / restaurant up in Chicago and other places that is called Medieval Times, where you can go see fake jousting and stuff. I think we took our kids there one time or a couple times. Kind of fun to watch. But it wasn't just the riders that had those breastplates on. It was also the horses that had their breastplates. Because if the horse goes down, so is the soldier on the horse. And so they wanted to protect them both. So it's not an uncommon sight to see either in ancient times or medieval warfare that the horses and the riders are wearing breastplates, something to protect their hearts. But these breastplates do something more based on what we see or how John sees them. They do something more than protect their hearts. They also reveal their hearts. They also reveal their true nature and character, as one writer says, as monsters of hell. I mean, these truly are monsters. This is a monstrous cavalry, as we'll get more into their description. In fact, some of their description comes straight out of the Old Testament, even out of the book of Job. that may remind us something of that Leviathan that actually breathed out fire. And of course, that was also a medieval thing where they would look at dragons. They had the fantasies of dragons, and it might have reflected something that existed in this world years before, but something that was fire-breathing, and something that was fearsome, something that was very fierce. Because here in verse 17, we're told that they have breastplates of what? Of fire and jacinth and brimstone. Now, in this verse, in verse 17, fire and jacinth and brimstone are all adjectives. In fact, they're the only place that you find these adjectives in the entire New Testament. So these are unique words to this particular unique verse. These are breastplates of fire and jacinth and brimstone. And they're all used to describe the appearance of the breastplates on both the soldiers and on the horses. More than likely, they refer to the colors that John saw on their armor. The colors. And one of the main reasons why we would say that is because even though we know what fire is, and even though we'll come to know a little bit more what brimstone is, jacinth is sort of a key to understanding what these three words are really meaning. Jacinth is really just the Greek transliteration for hyacinth. Some of you probably grown hyacinths. And the hyacinths back then especially were considered flowers that had a very deep, dark blue or red hue to them. And we'll look at here in a moment. But jacinth has the idea of a color of something. And so when we see that word jacinth as an adjective describing the breastplate as something that is a color of some kind of flower, then we see that related to that, the fire and the brimstone are also colors dealing with the breastplates that they have. And just like in ancient times, that's how you would identify your troops. You know, you might, again, look back at some of those medieval shows or whatever, and you're going to see the shield, you're going to see the breastplates, you're going to see what's on the horses, and they're going to have the colors of the armies. They identified who they belonged to and who they were. And so here we have three colorful descriptions that reveal the true heart, the true identity of this army. Each of these colors are associated with the judgments of hell. Each of these colors are associated with the judgments of hell. Again, of fire. Of fire. It's an adjective. And it means something that is of a fiery, shining color or glint, like a flame. That's orange. You know, a couple of days ago, my wife and I wanted to go out back, and we kind of nice night. We had a fire going, and that's what we saw. We saw the orangish, reddish flames coming off of our log. You know, and that's the idea here. That's the color that is being brought up here. It's orange, like a flame of fire. It's fiery looking. And then, as I mentioned, jacinth comes from the hyacinth flower, whose color was of a dark and dusky blue or red that bordered on black. So very dark, but it also had a little bit of one of those color hues to it. And obviously it's related to what we'll see later coming out of the horse's mouth, which was smoke. And so if you think of a color of smoke coming off of a huge furnace or out of a huge furnace, that's the idea here. Not a white smoke, but a dark, dusky, even really dark blue kind of smoke. And then, of course, brimstone. Brimstone is a common word in the Bible for rocks of sulfur. Sulfur. Rocks of sulfur can actually be found naturally, especially around volcanoes. I saw some pictures where people are harvesting sulfur, and they're actually on some of the vents near some volcanoes, not really a place I'd want to go. And it's interesting because you can actually see the yellow color, the bright yellow color of the sulfur that they are collecting. And so this element is known for its bright yellow color. It's also known for its offensive smell. It's also known for its ability to burn. I'm sure there's probably other elements and other rocks that can burn, but not so much so as sulfur rocks. That's one of the reasons why if you were to go to the Dead Sea today, which is where Sodom and Gomorrah were, which we'll look at here in a moment, when they were destroyed, you can actually find sulfur balls that were extinguished as they fell into the Dead Sea. Of course, this was God's judgment, and you can actually find them. They're all over the place. You can buy them online if you wanted to. And Joel Kramer, who is an archaeologist who I've mentioned before, I think we've seen some of his videos before, believer in Christ, Bible believer, really brings out Bible stories because of what we find in archaeology. But he went there once, And he showed us what those sulfur bowls look like. And they aren't yellowish because of some of the other stuff that's attached to them, but they are sulfur. You could smell it. And he says, you take a rock and you lit it and it would burn. And it would burn and burn and melt and just ooze. And it was really fascinating to see. And so this is the idea here. It's fiery, like the orange of a flame. It's of jacinth. It has this dark, dusty blue like that of smoke. It's brimstone. These are the colors of these breastplates. This identifies who they really are. And then, of course, the fire and the smoke and the brimstone, John will see coming out of the mouths of the horses. But all of these elements, like I mentioned before, are associated with the judgment of God in the Bible. Last passage to turn to. Let's go back to Genesis 19. Because these three, not colors, but these three elements, okay? So, yes, we're talking about jacinth as the color, but it's the color of the smoke, which is the element of judgment that God uses here in this judgment as well. But those three elements are first found in God's judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, like I mentioned to you in Genesis 19. And if you look at Genesis 19, verse 24, we find two of those elements. If someone could read that verse for us, Genesis 19, 24. So just in those few verses, what three elements do we find of God's judgment? Fire, brimstone, and smoke. And do you realize that these three elements of judgment will also be together in God's final place of judgment? You don't need to turn there, but in chapter 14 of Revelation, verses 10 and 11, you find those three elements again. So there's a connection of God's judgment in the sixth trumpet judgment, both backward to Sodom and Gomorrah's judgment, and then forward to the judgment of God's enemies. Now, in chapter 14, verses 10 and 11, it does refer to those who worship the beast, but it's also related elsewhere to the judgment of fallen angels and even the devil himself and the beast and the false prophet and all of them. And so, but in just those verses, chapter 14, verses 10 and 11, you have again, you've got the fire and the brimstone and the smoke. So what we have here in Revelation 9 is John seeing the colors of a fiery orange, a dusky blue, a bright yellow on the breastplates of those horses and those riders. And even though they might possess some kind of wispy quality to them, I mean, maybe it is kind of a cloudy vision. You know, obviously these are our spiritual beings. These are our demonic beings. These beings are ready to pour out the elements of hell on their victims. See, this is who they really are. They are spiritual beings destined for the very wrath and judgment of God. And they want to unleash what they will get in the end upon the enemies of God themselves. And so it just, even in Revelation 9, it just doesn't make sense why would they still be worshiping these demons, these devils. Because these devils and these demons want to harm them in the same way that they're going to be judged. It makes no true sense. Now, one question that I've seen in some of the literature is, were these three colors on each breastplate, or were they split up? You know, maybe one horse and rider was red, and one horse and rider had yellow, and one horse and rider had the dusky dark blue, or were they all kind of mixed in together, you know, like our flag, red, white, and blue, you know, all the flags that you see in the Olympics, they have different colors. Well, we're not told, obviously. I personally think that in John's vision, each breastplate looks the same because the heart of each one of these is the same. And the fire and the brimstone and the smoke will come from probably each one of the horses' mouths because of that strong connection between the judgment of God. So that gives us the foundation, I think, of what we will learn next, which is about the appearance of the horses themselves. So again, we learned a little bit about the number of the horsemen, the troops. Now we saw the appearance of the horses and the horsemen, and now we're going to just focus on the appearance of the horses, which will then unleash the very purpose, which is to slay the third part of men. But that's where we're going to end today.